As you have noticed, the first fork in this series covered the time period from creation to the death of Moses, the Pentateuch. The second fork have covered from the invasion of Canaan under Joshua to the end of the Judges period. As we begin number 9, we will enter upon a dramatic new period in the history of Israel. This period is known as the period of the monarchy. As you recall in our previous, we noticed that the people in 1 Samuel chapter 8 requested a king. Samuel gives them solemn warnings about what will take place when they set a king over themselves. And I will enumerate these warnings beginning in 1 Samuel 8 verse 11. He will take your sons and appoint them for himself, for his chariots and as horsemen, and some will run before his chariots. He will appoint captains over thousands and fifties. He will make your sons reap his harvest. He will take your daughters to be cooks and bakers. He will take your fields and your vineyards and your olive yards, even the best of them, and give them to his servants. He will take the tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give to his officers and his servants. And he will take your men servants and your maid servants and your asses and put them to his work. He will take the tenth of your sheep, and you shall be his servants. In the face of this solemn warning by Samuel, the people still request a king, and they cry even louder. In verse 19, they refused to obey, and they said, "No, but we will have a king to rule over us." And in verse 22, the Lord said to Samuel, "Hearken unto their voice and make them a king." With the beginning of the monarchy, a totally new system will develop in Israel. First of all, dynastic succession will take place. Prior to this, in the book of Judges, we read that God raised up judges when he was ready to have a deliverer for Israel. Now, under the monarchy, the king will expect to pass the crown on to his son, and then to his son's son, and so on. The reigning monarch will expect to have a house in perpetuity. He will expect to have his lineage and his posterity continue throughout the decades and the centuries as leaders in the nation. Secondly, there will be centralization of power. As indicated in the words of Samuel, the king will do what he wants when he wants to do it, and he will have the military force to back up his decisions. Third, a privileged class will develop. It will be a caste system, as we currently see in the land of India. There will be those who till the land and are peasants. There will be those who are merchants. But then there will be those who are friends of the court, friends of the king. These individuals will be those who have special privileges, and to whom the king will turn in time of need. The monarchy is the most important time period in the history of Israel. We know from our previous study in 1 Kings 6:1 that the monarchy began with the crowning of Saul in 1050 B.C. We discovered before that Saul reigned for 40 years and that David reigned for 40 years. 1 Kings 11:42 says, "And the time that Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over all Israel was 40 years." This indicates that there was a 120-year period during which time Saul, David, and Solomon reigned consecutively. The name that we shall give to this period is the period of the United Monarchy, because it was the only time in the history of Israel when all of the 12 tribes were united. If Saul was crowned king in 1050 B.C., and this period of the United Monarchy lasted for 120 years, then it came to an end in 931 B.C. In 931 B.C., we will learn that the kingdom divided, and Jeroboam became king of the northern 10 tribes, And Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, became king over Benjamin and Judah in the south. This period of the divided monarchy lasted for 209 years, from 931 until 722, when the Assyrians came in and dispersed the northern 10 tribes. Beginning in 722 BC and lasting down until 586 BC, we will have the period of Judah alone as a monarchy. Judah is alone because the northern kingdom of Israel has been dispersed into the nations. And in 586 BC, the kingdom of Judah, the southern kingdom, will be sent into Babylonian captivity. When Zedekiah, the last king of Judah, is slain, he will be the last human monarch ever to sit on the throne of Israel or Judah. As we continue our Old Testament study, the balance of Israel's history will take place under the umbrella of the monarchy until we reach the time of Babylonian captivity, the time of exile, and the return from captivity for that brief time period known as the period of the post-exilic community. As we recall, the desire of the children of Israel was to have a monarch like those of the other nations. God, in accordance with their request, granted them the most obvious man available. This man was Saul. 1 Samuel 9 introduces us to Saul, and we see immediately in verse 2 that he was a choice and handsome man. There was not a more handsome man in all the land of Israel. And not only was he the most handsome, he was the largest, because from his shoulders and up, he was taller than all the people in the land. Humanly speaking, here is a perfect choice for king. He's tall, he's handsome, and when Saul would dress himself in his kingly garments, I'm certain that he was a striking figure. And this is the kind of person that the children of Israel wanted to lead them out to battle, to fight their battles for them and to judge them as they went out and as they came in. Chapter 9 gives good examples of the sovereignty of God in the selection of Saul. In fact, God speaks to Samuel in verse 16 and says, "About this time tomorrow, I will send you a man." God's hand is evident throughout 1 Samuel 9 and 1 Samuel 10. Samuel meets Saul, and in verse 21, Saul answered and said, "Am I not a Benjamite? Why, I'm the smallest tribe in Israel, and my family is the least of all the families in the tribe of Benjamin. Why do you speak to me this way?" Saul was amazed that because he was from the least family in the smallest tribe that he would be selected. I call your attention to the fact that this was a wise move politically. Had someone been chosen from the tribe of Judah, jealousy would have occurred. But now we have the most handsome man, the biggest man, chosen from the smallest tribe. Who could say anything? In chapter 10, God is going to confirm his selection of Saul to Saul himself, through the instruction of Samuel. After Samuel anoints him as ruler over God's inheritance in 1 Samuel 10:1, he sets up some criteria for confirmation. And he says, beginning in verse 3, "When you leave here, you're going to get down as far as the terebinth at Tabor, and you're going to meet three men. And when you meet them, one is going to be carrying three little goats, the other one is going to be carrying three loaves of bread, and the other one is going to be carrying a jug of wine. And then they will greet you and give you two of the three loaves of bread, and you're going to take it from their hand. And then you'll keep walking, and you'll get up to the Philistine garrison, and you're going to run into a group of prophets. And then the Spirit of the Lord will come upon you, and you shall prophesy. And you'll be changed into another man." Notice how God makes the situation so complex that there is simply no way this could be a coincidence. You just don't walk along a road and meet three men that are going to God at Bethel, and one's going to be carrying three goats, and one carrying three loaves of bread, and one carrying a jug of wine, and one's going to give you two loaves of bread. That just doesn't happen unless God is sovereignly directing it. So Saul has direct, unquestionable confirmation from God that when Samuel anointed him as ruler over God's inheritance, that God was behind the anointing. And Saul would never have a reason to turn his back on God. And Saul would never have a reason to doubt that God had selected him as ruler over his people. In verse 17, Samuel calls the people together to the Lord at Mizpah, and the people love this place because it is where they defeated the Philistines 5 years earlier. Although we know that Saul has already been selected at the instruction of God through Samuel, it will not be a good move politically to allow the people to think that a selection has already been made without their knowing it. So God gathers all the tribes together, and he is going to demonstrate that it is his selection. He goes through the tribes and selects the tribe of Benjamin, verse 20. Then he brings the tribe of Benjamin nearby, and eventually Saul, the son of Kish, is taken. So the people get to see God's sovereign hand in the selection of their king. This is, by the way, different than the other monarchies, because in the other monarchies, the people would select the king, or else he would be of the warrior class and would crown himself king. This is still a theocracy, and God reaches down and selects the monarch that he wants to place in charge of his inheritance. And they looked for Saul, and he's gone. And I believe we can see here that as a young man, Saul is shy, he lacks self-confidence, and although he is handsome and large, he is not yet fully aware of his capabilities, and not yet fully aware that he has been made king over the entire inheritance of God. And they look for him and look for him, and he's hiding behind the baggage that the people have brought with them, as they all gathered together at Mizpah. They went over and they got Saul from behind the baggage and they lifted him up, and in verse 24 they shouted, "Long live the king!" Verse 26 says that Saul went to his house at Gibeah. Archaeologists have discovered what they believe to be the house of Saul. It was not a palace as we would think a king would inhabit, but it was a rustic fort. And I believe we can see by this that Saul, as the first monarch of Israel, was more of a rustic tribal chieftain than a king who dressed in silk and costly array. The people had selected a king because they wanted a military leader, a man who could go before them in battle. No sooner is Saul chosen as king than he gets his opportunity. Chapter 11 begins with the invasion by Nahash the Ammonite on the inhabitants of the city of Jabesh-Gilead. The inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead on the east side of the Jordan in the Trans-Jordan area were possibly caught by surprise and barely had time to close their gates when the armies of Nahash laid siege around the city. Being caught by surprise and not having time to gather provisions and water to withstand a long siege, the inhabitants of the city sent a messenger under a white flag and said to Nahash, "If you will make a covenant with us, or an agreement, a peace treaty, we will come out and serve you." And Nahash said, "Well, that's okay with me, but I'm going to gouge out the right eye of every one of you. And in this way, it will be a reproach on Israel." If I had been an inhabitant of Jabesh-Gilead, I don't think I would have anticipated with joy the thought of an Ammonite soldier gouging out my right eye. Evidently, they didn't either, so in verse 3 we read that they asked for a 7-day period of grace, during which time they could send messengers throughout the territory of Israel. And if no one came to their rescue, then they would agree to the terms of Nahash the Ammonite. The job description for the king had not been written at this time, And we find Saul plowing in the field. And as Saul is plowing in the field, the Spirit of God came mightily upon him when he heard that the Ammonites were going to reproach Israel by gouging out the right eye of the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead. And he cut the yoke of oxen in pieces and sent these pieces all around the territory and said the following, whoever does not come out after Saul and after Samuel, so shall it be done to his oxen. And the dread or fear of the Lord fell on the people, and they came out united as one man to follow Saul. And Saul unites the political and religious aspects of the kingdom by linking Samuel's name with his own. And we get to see that in this early period of the monarchy, Saul is a humble man. And the fighting men of Israel are numbered in Bezek, which is across the Jordan from Jabesh-Gilead. And we discover now the first hint of a later division. Because the sons of Israel were 300,000, and the men of Judah, 30,000. So they informed them that by the time the sun is hot, they would have deliverance. And needless to say, the inhabitants were glad. And in verse 10, the men of Jabesh-Gilead said to Nahash, we'll come out to you tomorrow, and you may do with us whatever seems good in your eyes. And I'm certain that they were speaking with tongue in cheek, because they knew by that time tomorrow, Saul, their new monarch, with his armies, would be in hot pursuit of Nahash and the Ammonites. And verse 11 says, they struck down the Ammonites until the heat of the day. Then the people said, who said shall Saul reign over us? Referring to those sons of Belial, back in verse 27 of chapter 10. But Saul said, no one shall die this day. And we see Saul in a humble attitude as he enjoys the fruits of victory from his first military encounter, and the hearts of the people are wedded to his. Chapter 12 contains the historical narrative given by Samuel to the people of Israel. And he reminds them of everything that God has done for them, and he reminds them that he has not defrauded anyone. Samuel demonstrates his knowledge of the period recorded in the Pentateuch and during the period of the Judges in verses 8 through 11, because he reminds the people of Jacob, and he reminds the people of Moses and Aaron, and then Sisera and the Philistines and the king of Moab, and how the people served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. And then God sent Jerubbaal or Gideon and Jephthah and Samuel, and he includes himself in this list of historical characters. And by now, during the time of Samuel, the people have begun to serve the Baals again. And if you recall, Baal is responsible for fertility of crops. And Samuel says to them in verse 17, is it not the time for the wheat harvest today? Just so you will know that Baal is not in charge, I am going to call the Lord, and he is going to send thunder and rain. And you will know that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Lord, by asking for a king. And he's going to demonstrate that they were wrong in asking for a king in advance of God's program. And he will validate the fact that God is in charge of the elements of nature responsible for fertility and not Baal. And he called the Lord, and the Lord sent thunder and rain, and the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel. 1 Samuel 13:1 indicates that after Saul had reigned for 2 years, that he began to select an army of specialized troops. Based on this, we can assume that the year is approximately 1048 or 1047 B.C. We know it is early in the reign of Saul because verse 35 says that Saul built an altar to the Lord. It was the first altar that he built to the Lord. Assuming it is 1048 B.C., when Saul puts his son Jonathan in charge of the specialized armies, then Jonathan must be a man of 20 or 21 years of age. And that means that Saul must be at least in his mid-40s and was selected to be king when he was approximately 40 years of age. Again, we are inferring this because we do not know specifically the age of Saul, but the chronology seems to indicate that Saul was in his early 40s when he was crowned king, and at that time may have had a son almost 20 years of age. Assuming that young Jonathan is about 22 years of age in 1048 B.C., this means that he would have been born in 1070 B.C. Saul's life is marred by four tragic sins. Three of these sins will be the reasons why God will cut off Saul's house, and in his case will be the reason why dynastic succession does not occur. No seed of Saul will ever sit on the throne of Israel. In chapter 13, Saul, in anxious anticipation of the arrival of Samuel, is not patient enough. And in verse 9, Saul said, "Bring the burnt offering." And he offered the burnt offering. And it came about as soon as he finished offering it, Samuel came, and Samuel said in verse 11, "What have you done?" And Saul knew that he was not to attempt to enter into the office of the priesthood. And Samuel said, "You've acted foolishly. The Lord would have established your kingdom forever over Israel." In other words, dynastic succession would have occurred. Jonathan would have been your successor. The crown would have been on his head, and Jonathan's son would have been on the throne. But now, verse 14, "Your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out a man for himself after his own heart and has appointed him ruler over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you." What year is it? 1048 B.C. We will later learn that David was crowned king over Judah in 1010 B.C. and that he was 30 years of age. This means that he was born in 1040 B.C. And here we are in 1 Samuel chapter 13, verse 14, with Samuel telling Saul, "The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart," and it's 1048 B.C., 8 years before David's born. I'm reminded of Luke chapter 1 in verses 14 through 17, when the angel says that John will be a forerunner. He's going to turn the hearts of the fathers back to the children. And this promise is made even before he's conceived. Ephesians 2:10 says, "We are his workmanship, created unto good works that we should walk in them." Chapter 13 has some interesting information for us from an archaeological perspective. Remembering that it is 1048 B.C., only 7 years have transpired since the Battle of Mizpah, when the Philistines were defeated after their 40-year occupation of the land. Verse 17 says that no blacksmith could be found in all the land of Israel, because the Philistines had not let them have blacksmiths in the fear that they would make weapons for themselves. Therefore, the people fought with axes and ox goads and plowshares, and so on, but no one had weapons, with the exception of Saul and Jonathan. The remainder of chapter 14 introduces us to two important genealogies and covers a period of 22 years. In verse 3, we see, "And Ahiah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh, was wearing the ephod. The son of Eli was Phinehas. The sons of Phinehas were Ichabod and Ahitub. And the son of Ahitub is Ahiah, which is a short form of Ahimelech. And we can see that in 1 Samuel 22, 9 to 12 and verse 20. Later we will find that Abathar the priest is the son of Ahiah, or also called Ahijah or Ahimelech. The other important genealogy is in chapter 14, verses 49 and 50, and we will see that the name of Saul's wife in verse 50 was Ahinoam, and the name of the captain of his army was Abner, the son of Ner, Saul's uncle. Back in 9:1, we will see that Abiel gave birth to Kish and Ner. Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner was the father of Abner. So the commander-in-chief of the armies of Israel is named Abner, and he is Saul's first cousin. Saul's sons are listed, and the chronology is continued in 1 Chronicles 8:33, where we discover that in addition to the sons mentioned in 1 Samuel 14:49, Saul's other two sons were named Eshbaal and Ishbosheth. Verse 47 is a summary of all the battles which take place during the next 22 years. So between 1 Samuel 14:52 and 1 Samuel 15:1, there is a 22-year gap. Therefore, we can put a date of 1026 BC on the events which take place in chapter 15. As mentioned before, there were four tragic sins in the life of Saul which brought about God's censure and judgment on his life and kingdom. Chapter 15 gives the account of the second of these four sins. To understand more fully the impact of this sin as recorded in chapter 15, it is necessary to go back to Deuteronomy 25:19 to begin to build a historical base for the events in chapter 15. Deuteronomy 25:19 reads, "Therefore it shall be, when the Lord thy God hath given thee rest from all thine enemies round about, in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance to possess it, that thou shalt blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven, thou shalt not forget it." This is a commandment from God to the children of Israel. This is a commandment which must be obeyed, and it is prophetic as well. The task of blotting out Amalek falls on the shoulders of Saul, the first monarch of Israel.